Good morning and welcome to the May 17, 2021 meeting of Chelan County Public Utility District Number 1. Today is both a study and a business session, and all five commission are here today, commissioners. The normal staff are staffing the meeting, that being our general manager, Steve Wright, clerk of the board, Rebecca Garfine, and our attorney, Eric Walquist. Due to the COVID virus, we are meeting remotely, and while normally I'd remind everybody to silence their cell phones, I still will if you're not on mute, but I try to remember to ask you to stay on mute unless you're speaking, because it makes the meeting run just a lot better. We value public input in our meetings, and we'll be providing an opportunity for the public to have input at the end of our morning session and at the end of our afternoon session. If you wish to speak, we ask that you provide your name and address for the record, as our meetings are recorded, and we wish to have an accurate record of your input. Additionally, if you're wanting to speak to any item on the agenda, I will ask for that in a few minutes to see if there's anybody in the audience that wishes to speak to any agenda item during the course of the meeting. Our flag salute and our safety minute today will be brought to us by Rob Witham, and I will hand it off to Rob at this moment.
All right, thank you very much. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. So, good morning. Again, my name is Rob Witham, and I am the trainer for the System Operations Group. For this morning's Safety Minute, I am going to discuss eye strain. So, our computers, our tablets, our smartphones, all helpful devices, and all this technology has become essential in providing new and creative solutions to overcome some of the challenges that we've been presented in the past year or so, both personally and professionally. But when used for long periods of time, these devices can expose our eyes to a lot of strain. One big reason is that we simply don't blink enough, roughly 50% less than what we normally do. And as a result, all this can lead to a number of symptoms, including dry eyes, headaches, and blurred vision. So, what can we do about it? Well, I like to introduce the 20-20-20 rule, if you haven't heard of it before. If followed, it helps reduce fatigue and eye strain. It's pretty simple and states, every 20 minutes, take at least 20 seconds and look away from your screen and focus on something else that is at least 20 feet away from you. Now, it's best if you can get up out of your chair and stretch your legs and arms. Obviously, there's many benefits of kind of stepping away and stretching from time to time. But if you can't get away from your desk, how about this? Look about 10 feet away on the floor and just trace some figure eights and do that for about 30 seconds. That's another way to kind of help, you know, get your eyes moving around, kind of promote some tear production. And then finally, blink. Just normally it's an involuntary motion that we do, but sometimes we got to help our body a little bit and just kind of focus on blinking some more. The other thing you can do is you can just squeeze your eyes. Don't close them for too long, particularly if you're at work. That might not be the best alternative. But the last thing you can do is do a warm compress and place that over your eyes. Another thing you can do is just kind of rub your hands together and just place them over your eyes. Again, you want nice, healthy, you know, productive, tearful eyes. For your workspace, when we're talking ergonomics, you want to keep your screen about an arm's length away. If you need to, adjust your screen size. You know, a lot of folks, including myself from time to time, will have that phone far too close. You want to keep it a good arm's length away from you. The other thing you can do is adjust your screen's brightness as well as the lighting in your office or your home. And if your screen is too bright, your eyes have to work too hard. So you want to have a nice balance there. One of the cool things that you're starting to see now is this concept or this technology called bias lighting. is where they'll put a light actually behind your TV or behind your computer monitor, and it kind of reduces the contrast of the bright light in the monitor versus the surrounding environment. Again, it's all there to help reduce eye strain. All right, so this morning's meeting is scheduled for about 2 hours, so that means all of you guys will have at least 5 to 6 opportunities to exercise some good eye strain prevention. So with that, thank you for your time, and have a good rest of your morning.
Thank you. Very, very good safety moment. A new one that all of us probably need to pay close attention to. I'm assuming that when, you know, take that break from your iPhone, you don't go to a 60-inch television that's 20 feet away. That doesn't serve the purpose.
Not as much as you would hope.
Okay. But that is, because, you know, the devices being such a part of our life, that's really very timely and a good moment.
Well, I hope so.
Any questions or additional comments from my fellow commissioners? Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yes. item 2 on our agenda is the approval of the agenda. And I have to admit, I do not recall if there were any recommendations for moving of agenda items. Were there?
There were. Staff recommends that agenda items 10 and 11 be moved to the consent.
I'll make that motion.
Second. Okay, motion has been made and seconded to move items 10 and 11 to the consent agenda. And... is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Okay.
Aye.
So the consent agenda has opposed. So the consent agenda has been amended to include agenda items 10 and 11. And we'll move on now to agenda item number 3. And I'll hand it off to Steve Wright.
This is going to be a really enjoyable time for me because we have 2 CPO winners today that I am really proud to be talking about. I think these are really deserving winners here. First up, I want to talk about Amy Smith. So Amy is in our finance group. I will tell you that I became aware of her work shortly after I came here when I heard from our auditors about what high-quality work we do in this area. And I asked about why that is, and Amy's name came right to the top of the list. So she has very clearly adopted the whole philosophy of a cycle of personal ownership. She's been that way for a long time, since I've been here, probably long before that. She is really good at thinking about what issues are arising and getting in front of them so that when the auditors show up to talk about something, it's already well understood, documentation is in place, and in fact, there's probably even been conversations with the auditors in advance. It makes life so much easier for them and for us, and certainly is a big contributor to getting a clean audit opinion. I have to say that one of the learnings in my career is that accounting is something that is dynamic. It changes through time. It changes significantly. And you have to stay on top of it, and you have to be committed to continuous improvement in order to be good at it. And Amy is just a terrific example of that. We'd like to take a moment and talk about the second winner, too, before we give Amy a chance to share with the board. Min Dong is in our procurement group. And Min was nominated for a specific item having to do with a contract that was helping to support activities at B10. We had some COVID-related issues with our dive crew, and we were trying to get a contract in place. We needed it in place quickly in order to be able to address the fact that we had some COVID infections within the dive crew. I want to go beyond that, though, and say Min has been on my screen for a number of years, because when I ask about people who are doing a really good job. Ben's name comes up consistently. Very committed to great internal customer service, focusing on what are the highest priorities and then making sure that that work gets accomplished and doing it with quality. We're trying to push a lot of work through this organization with the big increases in capital and O&M spend that we have put in place. And so she has done a really great job of helping to make us successful as we try to do best for the most for the longest. And I was really glad to see both Amy and Min's name come up because it seemed like they are just the kind of folks that we were thinking about when we put Cycle of Personal Ownership in place. With that, I'd like to turn to Amy first and just ask if she has anything she'd like to share with the board.
Yeah, I'd just like to say thank you, Steve, and really appreciate the acknowledgement. Certainly can't take all the credit for the audit. We have a whole great group in finance that does work towards that all year. And, you know, the audit really is a culmination of what we do all year long, all of our regular work. And, you know, I've always taken the approach that we want to be very proactive, whether it's new accounting guidance or new transactions the district's entering into, that we are fully aware of the impacts of that, how we're going to handle it. And then as far as audit prep, you know, my goal is always to have all the schedules that the auditors ask for ready before they arrive, so that we have a chance to review them. And if there's anything out there, we know about it before they do. So really consider the audit just a formality and the culmination of everything we do all year long. And like I said, there's a lot of great individuals that contribute to that effort. So, you know, so much of what we do is really behind the scenes, and when things are going well, you know, people don't need to hear about it or think about it. So it is nice to be acknowledged for all that effort that we're putting in every day. So I'd like to say thank you.
Min, is there anything that you would like to share with the board today?
Good morning, commissioners. Good morning, everyone. My name is Min Dang, contract specialist. I've been trying hard to set my foot here since I came to the U.S. and I joined the district in 2017. And this is my second award. And I find it's very rewarding. The people I work with are nice and smart, and I get all the support that I need to do my work. And the teamwork here is excellent. I'm very thankful for all of this. And this is actually a teamwork indeed. I could not do everything on my own. And then very proud to work with the district. So thank you very much.
I want to thank both Amy and Min, and both of you shared something in your what you just said that speaks hugely to me, and that is the humbleness with which you approach your job and are willing to share the fact that none of us individually gets things done, but that humility speaks volumes about your ability to work with people and the work to encourage good work to be accomplished. And that's a really powerful asset that both of you are sharing. And I want to say thank you so much.
Thank Commissioner? You, Len.
Yeah. Commissioners?
I would just like to add my 2 cents and say thank you and congratulations, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Steve.
Okay. Next up, we want to get to the quarterly energy resources update. Rob Davis and Janet Jaspers will be presenting today. Rob, I think you're on mute.
All right, let me try that again. Good morning, Rob Davis, Center Managing Director of Energy Resources. I was just noting that even though we do this on a quarterly basis and you're familiar with it, it's always a fun presentation, and particularly this time around, 2021 has been an interesting year. I thought we would be coming in today to tell you mostly about the winter event and how that changed things and maybe some other market activities, but it's just continued to be an odd year. You may have noticed just the dryness and river conditions, and it is having an impact really west-wide. So Janet's got some great slides on that, and we'll talk about that, but we'll jump right into our Q1 update. Next slide, please. So again, we'll talk about our portfolio and let you know where things are with our recent transactions. You'll get the operation and planning update along with the discussion of fundamentals and some market news as well. Excellent. So, as always, the high point, how are we doing? We are forecasted to be above budget again. So we have, as you see there, $68 million was the forecast and $600,000 higher than budget for the year. Other energy-related revenues forecast to be $14 million, which is almost $4 million higher than budget. So together, the forecast is about $4.4 million over budget for 2021. Next slide. Just run through some highlights on changes out here in the West in the power markets. Continuing updates on resource adequacy. So continue to meet in the subgroups, make progress. We're hoping to have another milestone here in the next month or two that we can report out on and come back to you guys and give you more detail. We're looking at whether we should do the interim solution again for this summer. This was done last summer and also last winter, where we do some data analysis and modeling to see if there's some benefits that we can gain related to resource adequacy even before we have the program in place. Janet's been very involved in that. It's a good program. It really just, at this point, relies on people providing data so we can do the modeling. In the short-term markets arena, we always, as always, continue to monitor things going on with CAISO. Print continues to grow with new people joining every year. Governance, we continue to watch, and there's a proposal that should be coming out relatively soon. Interesting development on this. There will be a real test of their governance model coming up. There's a proposal for CAISO's summer readiness that drew differing opinions from the EIM governing body and the CAISO board. So we'll see how that plays out both at FERC and down in California to give us some indications of how their governance structure is going to work in the long term. Next slide. More changes out here in the West. State carbon policies. We're working on our clean energy implementation plan that we'll be submitting as required by CETA. And then the Climate Commitment Act. This is the cap and invest program that was recently passed. I think this bullet's out of date. I believe the governor has already signed the bill. So things moving quickly on that front. We have an update for you in more detail on that later in the morning session. Then finally, wanted to mention the Southwest Power Pool and their Western Energy Imbalance Service. We had talked about this a little bit on our governance discussion last month, but they went live start of February with a set of utilities in the Rocky Mountain area, and it's actually expanding. Colorado Springs Utilities recently announced that they're going to join, and they, along with several of the other utilities that are already participating, are also investigating moving to full RTO membership within SPP. So they have a study underway for that, but the imbalance service market is up and running. So now we have two market operators running organized markets in the West. At this point, I will hand over to Janet for a more detailed discussion on our portfolio and position.
Okay. Thanks, Ron. And my name is Janet Jaffers, Director of Energy Planning and Trading. So good morning, Commissioner. So we're on slide 6, and this is our two charts showing the district energy commitments. And from the last time we talking to you. We have a couple of differences. The main difference is the light blue, which is the market-based license. We have actually executed two new market-based licenses. That's a little bit different. On the and I guess the other point on this slide is the red horizontal line across the top is really our maximum hedge limit, so we're within policy. On the next slide, we do have more detail on that light blue market-based light. So slide 7, please. So the two new slices since our last quarterly update, the first one is a Vista long-term slice, and it's shown in the orange, and so it's a 5% Rocky Ridge Rock Island. The term is 10 years, and it's 2024 through 2033. The second one was our slice auction held in March. Puget Sound Energy was the winner, and it's really shown on my screen, it looks kind of dark red. It's kind of a brownish color. And it's for 5% Rocky Ridge Rock Island for a five-year term, 2022 through 2026. And both of these are just part of that execution of the long-term hedging program. Next slide, slide 8. So we always kind of watch natural gas prices. A lot of times it's a leading indicator for electricity pricing. And so off to the right, you can see what the price of a June contract, June 2021, for a Henry Hub, $2.89 for MMBTU. When we came to you last quarter, it was $2.84. We've seen some shifts in weather forecasts that were bearish, sometimes bullish, on the storage, which has moved price around, but ultimately very little change in February. And so next slide, slide 9, if you zoom out and you just look at that same contract, the June contract for a longer period of time, it's that yellow rectangle on the bottom right-hand corner. And so you can just see we are really in a low natural gas price environment compared to that history period.
Janet, may I ask a question, please?
Sure.
Why do we use Henry Hub as the maybe the guidance here or the information here?
I think it has the very most volume of any hub. It's the largest, and so since it is the largest and has the most volume, it's kind of the one everything is indexed off of. So there's like a spread basis to Henry Hub. So maybe CMS might be closer here. And so it's kind of just a probably better overall indicator of supply demand.
Okay. I appreciate that. You know, there's so many hubs, and it just dawned on me why this one, but thanks for the answer. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. So slide 10 shows the mid-C forward price curve for flat electricity, and it's ISTA hidden in the C pricing for out through 2026. At budget time, which was November 3rd, 2020, the 2021 flat price was $31 per megawatt hour, and that was the budget time. So the current price for that is $35.49, which is an increase of $4.49 per megawatt hour. And if you just kind of concentrate on the left-hand side of the chart, we have the year 2021. And you can notice that the black line, which is the current forward price curve, the solid black line, you can see in Q1, Q2, quite a bit higher than that dashed gray line, which was at budget. And then out July and August, you can see that we've really kind of peaked out there too. And we'll kind of share a little bit more with you. Just because prices in 2021 have increased, we call it kind of scarcity pricing. You can see that even out 2022 through 2026, Q3, the block length of Q3 has actually risen quite a bit since November when we set the budget. Slide 11. One thing that we just really wanted to highlight this quarter is we kind of see this summer squeeze. We've kind of called it on this line. And we've just seen the price of July, August, September really increase. So these two lines on this chart, the orange one was Q3 pricing for 2020 Q3. The blue line is Q3 pricing for 2021. And just to show the contrast, so back in January, the forward price for both years was about the same. Kind of going through the year, and we actually had close to normal water supply forecasts for both frankly a little bit lower at the Dalles, but our water forecasts were looking pretty good mid-February. Since then, we have had super low precip, and so the water forecasts really have taken a nosedive in the Northwest, and California water supply is really decreasing too. And so the blue line, we've just seen kind of some exponential increases in that on peak for Q3. And right here, I think it was May 10th, we had the price of $121 per megawatt hour. I just got from Mike this morning that today the last trade was $125. So people are super cautious about what the summer is going to bring. We have in the West, 2021 versus 2020, the water supply, as I said, in the Northwest in California is quite a bit lower than last year. We have seen some coal retirements since last year. In 2021, California had some what you kind of call this term COVID demand destruction, which means some of the manufacturing was shut down, some of the businesses were shut down. And so the load wasn't as high. A lot of that has recovered. And so they're expecting higher loads in California too. People are pretty nervous, and prices for this summer are getting up there. Going to slide 12, we just kind of wanted to show you too some of the conditions of the reservoirs in California. We kind of watched that too and see how much hydro they're going to have. So if you take a look at the top of the page, two of the reservoirs, largest reservoirs, are Lake Shasta and Lake Orville. And so that red horizontal line is what the reservoir level would be on an average year. So, and then the blue column is the current reservoir level. So you can see that almost all of the reservoirs are a lot lower than what they would be on a typical average year. So a growing concern, definitely. Switching gears, going to slide 13, looking at net wholesale revenue and other energy-related revenue. Kind of at the top portion of the graph, the gray shaded line, the net wholesale revenue subtotal, like Rob had said on the highlight, we're about 600,000 higher now. Our forecast is 600,000 higher than it was at budget. And then the other energy-related revenue is also higher. It's about 3.7 million higher, so in total 4.4. A large chunk of that is a long-term power contract routine surplus of 3.1 million. So, and then part is due to the higher prices that we are seeing. Next slide, slide 14. Taking a look at the net wholesale revenue, and this one is including the off-system menu sale. which is added on to the numbers from the last line. So right now, the black line is showing that wholesale revenue forecast, and so real close to $90 million. If you look out on the curve through 2027, it's actually fairly close to last quarter's wholesale revenue. And in slide 15, taking a look at what's new happening in the market. So besides high prices this summer, one thing that's kind of different is PowerX. Released their clean energy standards. So this was instead of like a regulatory body issuing a standard or a state issuing a standard. This came from PowerX itself. They did go to a province and they did get approval. They ran it kind of passed them too. But it's really a voluntary standard and it's really to make sure that there's no resource shuffling. Sometimes some of the customers want to make sure that maybe you're not importing some dirty power and serving your load with it and selling your clean generation. And so there's several different rules in this clean energy standard that PowerX has just adopted. Anyway, it just really assures that their sales are going to be clean sales and that they're serving their load with clean power. And they made it so that any other entities who were interested could easily adopt the same clean energy standard. So, slide 16, just to kind of re-summarize, our total forecasted net wholesale revenues are $82 million, which is 4.4 higher than budget. So I will open it up for questions.
Questions, commissioners? I guess I have one for Rob or Janet. I'm not certain whom. Are we starting to see any, I guess I would call it decoupling of hydro prices from natural gas prices based on what's going on in our state with the clean power plant?
That's a good question. I'll take a first crack at it. I don't know that we are seeing decoupling, but we have definitely seen strong response to our offerings because we're selling hydro and because hydro is now gaining parity with other renewables. So we, both in our Avista contract and in our annual slice auction, got really good results. And I think a lot of that is driven by the clean nature of it and the fact that both those purchasers have Washington state requirements to use clean energy. So I think that's, I don't know that it's being decoupled, but we're definitely seeing more valuation of the environmental attributes.
Yeah, and I think that I wouldn't say decoupling either. So when we show the forward price curve, that's just for any power. And so if we were to sell what we call specified source power, we would get a premium to that pricing. So so I guess it's still usually tied to natural gas if that's the incremental resource. But then the clean attribute, you can capture that premium for the clean attribute.
Thank you. Gary, you have a question?
I have a question, if I may. Is it logical to assume that with climate change and drought conditions in the desert Southwest, including California, that there'll be a continuation, potential continuation of lack of refill for their aquifers and for their water supply, that is, can you make the leap at that point that that will continue to increase our wholesale pricing on our product in that, in those markets?
You know, I think that's a fair assumption. I think there have been studies done on that. I haven't looked at it closely. They have a number of supply issues in California, though. So this is one of several that they're grappling with. In addition to the drought conditions, they're retiring their last nuclear plant. Coal is pretty much gone. They have their once through cooling plants that are being retired, and it's also very difficult to get new capacity built down there. So all of those things are coming together to really give them a bad supply problem. And it's being compounded because their reliance on imports isn't a viable strategy anymore, because coal is being retired in the Northwest and the Southwest. You have drought conditions in the Northwest and Southwest. You have transmission shutoffs in the summer and fall during fire season. So it's a lot of things coming together to really exacerbate what's happening there. So that's going to drive market prices, but I think we'll also see, our own capacity issues in our own region, capacity and deliverability issues that'll push it as well.
Thank you.
Commissioners, if I could, I want to make a couple of points here. Rebecca, would you go back to page 6, please? I think there are two significant new pieces of information in this report. The first is the sales that we've made to Puget and Avista, which decreases the available supply, that you can see in particularly in the fixed price graph, where they're just pretty small amounts that are available for the remaining 5 years of this period. That actually gives us some room to implement the long-term marketing strategy to focus on the longer-term replacements for the cost-plus contracts that come due in 2028, 2031. And something that we've been working on, you know that from our previous discussions, and expect to be pretty heavily engaged in that discussion or those kinds of discussions this summer. The second thing is the dramatic price run-up this summer, which I think raises questions about, do we have risk associated with the summer period? We've looked at our inventory. We feel comfortable that, at least based on today's conditions, that we're long going into the summer. Now, things can change. We continue to see a decrease in the stream flow forecast. That would be the number one issue for us that would give us concern. Other things could change as well, but at least right now we feel comfortable that we're walking into the summer season in reasonably good shape and not exposed in any extraordinary way to the market conditions. We've given some considerations as to whether we want to alter our marketing strategy for this summer. Is there a way to take advantage of these high prices, and have concluded that in general, no, that we feel like we're positioned well with what we've got, and we're just going to walk into it with the length that we have. That's it.
Steve, if I could ask a question, you might recall at one of the previous board presentations when we were talking about power sales, one of the suggestions was to do a 1% experiment in terms of how to market, just utilizing or exposing 1% or less of our load. Would that 1% perhaps be a candidate for this unknown summer demand season?
Yeah, I think that given the change in policy that we made last year, I think we are effectively implementing that today, because we're walking in with a small amount of length going into the summer, and we will see our real-time prices. Now, of course, you see real-time loads and resources too, so we can't guarantee how much will be available, and what we'll see is just whatever length we have will get sold, and we'll capture that in terms of the day-to-day prices that show up. So I think we have that effectively working going into this year.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
But by the way, there's a chance to potentially add to Rob and Janet's comments as well about the decoupling, and I think it applies to Commissioner Arsenault's comments or question as well. The coupling really occurs in two ways, the long-term sales and then the short-term sales. Short-term sales are just the, you know, what's going on in the market right now, which tends to be driven by what we call heat rate. Heat rate is the use of combustion turbines and which how efficient or inefficient are the plants are that are being used. What we will be able to, what we are not really seeing right now is a big change in those because carbon pricing is kind of limited in Washington State. We see some reflection in west-wide markets in the real-time prices, but that will become greater through time. And in fact, there's even some discussion about potentially creating different products that would be available that would be clearer about their carbon-free nature. So I think you could say it's beginning to happen. We're beginning to see the prices, and we would expect that to grow through time in the real-time market. And we, as Rob and Janet said, we're already seeing it in the longer-term markets more clearly.
Well, thank you, Rob. Thank you, Janet. Good report. Power sales is very important to our organization. We know it. Thanks again.
Commissioners, we're going to keep Rob online as we move to the next item here. Rob has been our lead in thinking through a whole set of transmission access issues, and the next step for us will be large generator and load interconnection agreements. So, Rob, take it away, please.
Thank you. Sort of putting my other hat on, did a lot of work on this for the district, my staff attorney role. And so it got to a point where we wanted to come and have an initial conversation with you. I was here last month talking about corporate governance, now this month talking about transmission interconnection agreements. It's really a quest to see how dry and arcane a topic I can bring before you kick me out for good. So, slide two is the agenda of what we're going to talk about today. This is going to be pretty high level, but absolutely pepper me with questions. It's I've been steeped in it long enough that I find it fun now. So talk a little bit about background. This will be how we got to where we are in the interconnection space, some FERC history. Talk about district initiatives. As Steve mentioned, we've been thinking about this for a while now, a few years, working on some transmission and interconnection-related policies and practices. We're kind of getting to the finish line and bringing it to you in bite-sized chunks. We'll talk about the interconnection process and the template agreement, give you an overview of that in advance of coming back later to talk to you about it in more detail. Slide three, we just some background on FERC and FERC's rules and regulations around providing transmission and interconnection service. So, started deregulation, we had the Energy Policy Act 1992, and part of what that did was grant FERC some additional authorities for remedying discrimination. So they already had the ability for investor owns to review rates and terms and conditions to make sure they weren't discriminatory, but FERC was given additional authority to actually order utilities to provide wheeling service and to provide interconnection service, and that included traditionally non-jurisdictional utilities. So after that, FERC could take an application from somebody that wanted to interconnect, for example, to Chelan's system, and they would go through an evidentiary hearing and determine if it was warranted and what conditions would surround it and issue an order that would require us to provide that interconnection service. A few years later, they issued their landmark order that put forth a pro forma open access tariff. So this basically made uniform the provision of transmission service by all investor owns. The EPAC 1992 didn't quite go far enough for them in addressing vertically integrated utilities preferencing their own merchant activities. So with the open access transmission tariff, everyone would get the same access to the transmission system that the incumbent utility got. And so this was intended to really level the playing field. This was only applied to investor owns, but they added a provision, a reciprocity provision, that anyone taking service would have to agree to provide reciprocal service on their own system. And the idea was that for those utilities, the non-jurisdictionals that FERC couldn't exercise authority over, that they could at least apply some pressure to get them to provide open access service. And as this was being developed, LPPC was very heavily involved, other trade associations for the non-jurisdictionals, and helped guide the process to a place that was at least a little better from the perspective of consumer-owned utilities. And at the end of it, several LPPC members actually voluntarily adopted the transmission tariff, as did BPA and I believe WAPA as well. So that was FERC's foray into transmission, and then they realized that they needed to apply similar controls, regulations around interconnection. So in 2003, they issued order number 2003 to address standardized procedures for interconnecting large generators. So they adopted a set of procedures which went all the way from the initial application through all the various studies required, addressed how to order applicants from first to last, depending on when they applied and how their application would affect the system, all the way to a standardized template agreement once the studies were complete for the developer to sign and assign their responsibility. So this became part of the pro forma tariff. All investor owns have to adopt and follow this procedure and have to use this agreement. There's obviously ability to negotiate and modify some terms for specific circumstances, but it is a pro forma agreement that accompanies the pro forma tariff. Shortly after that, we got Energy Policy Act 2005, and you might be seeing a theme that over the years, there's been attempts to continue addressing discrimination in transmission service where incumbent utilities are able to use their systems to get market advantage. So this time around, the process for FERC to address some discrimination was vastly simplified. So previously, they had to have a hearing, run through a set of required showings, develop the evidence. EPEC 2005 really just set out that FERC can address non-comparable or discriminatory preferential treatment by rule or order. And it's a very open power that they have. They haven't exercised it a lot, but it is really designed to allow them to be flexible in how they address discrimination in the provision of transmission service. And again, like the first Energy Policy Act, this new authority also applies to non-jurisdictional utilities. So the theme here is that we need to make sure that we have here at Chelan transmission policies, interconnection policies that are non-discriminatory, and that we can demonstrate are non-discriminatory in the event that somebody comes along and says that they want to interconnect or take service on our system. So we have that. We believe that we've been in compliance with all that. But getting something that is more more formal, something that is spelled out and repeatable is in our interest. So on slide 4, I'll tell you a little bit about some of the things that we've been doing in this regard. As you remember, we came to you last summer for approval of new transmission rates. Those rates were based on the FERC model that's set out in their pro forma tariff. We developed that really good work by the folks in the transmission group, brought on some consultants, worked through it, and got those rates to you. What we're discussing today is the interconnection agreement, and it may seem a little out of order for us to come to you with the agreement first and then talk to you about the process later, but as you're all aware, there's a lot of activity with new loads here in the region, Douglas County getting folks looking to come on board their system, and we as well have been getting inquiries and requests from generators and large loads. So this is one of those situations where it's easier to have those discussions and negotiate a final agreement if we've thought about what we want to be in there in the first place. So making sure that we are prepared for anything that may come up in the next few months or years is why we want to get this in front of you first. But as you can see, we're going to come back at the end of this quarter to discuss it in more detail. And then by the end of this year, come back with the rest of it. So the broader package of transmission policies and practices. So this will cover transmission service requests. This will cover how we set up our system model, all the studies, all the accounting and billing, full package that we've been working on for a few years. The interconnection process is part of that. It's been under development as well, but we thought that getting the agreement in front of you first, since that's the really critical item if somebody is ready to move forward and interconnect to our system. Also wanted to talk briefly about large load interconnection. The pro forma tariff is primarily focused on large generator connection. However, during the first cryptocurrency boom a few years ago, we got lots and lots of folks telling us they wanted to hook up, take off lots and lots of megawatts. The transmission group and the customer utilities group worked together to set up a process for how they would study the impacts on the transmission system, how they would queue up different requests. And as they were developing that, they tied into the work that we were doing on the transmission side for generators and really made sense to sync it up. So we're going to add the large load interconnection process as part of the package, the entire transmission policies and procedures package that we come back to you with at the end of the year. Slide five. Some highlights of the interconnection process. It all starts with the application. So somebody looking to connect to our system, we'll get people to call and ask questions, you know, where do you have capacity? What do your rates look like? About how long does it take? And we're always happy to talk to them, but we tell them that the formal process starts with an application. Following that, there are a series of studies that have to be done. Feasibility is like it sounds, just will this proposal work on our system, followed by a system impact study to see in more detail what a proposed load, large load or generator will do to the existing system. And then finally, a facility study to see what specific equipment would have to be installed to make the connection work and to energize. There's some related studies that may be necessary, so an affected system study. Obviously, what happens on our system may not stay here, and so we coordinate with our neighbors, and they coordinate with us when they get interconnection requests to make sure that the entire grid is properly planned for and designed and continues to operate reliably. Environmental studies to the effect that they are needed. We have provisions in our process to make sure that we are not running afoul of any environmental or cultural resource obligations. And then the studies are all paid for by the interconnection customer. They post deposits. We draw against those deposits and then true up with a final bill or credit once all the studies are done, or once each study is done, rather. Interconnection agreement, either large loads that aren't purchasing power from the district. We've had several inquiries on that. And the concept there is that a large load may come in, interconnect at transmission voltages, purchase power from the market or a dedicated supplier, and that we would simply be using our transmission system to deliver that power to them. The other interconnection agreement would be for a large generator. This is going to be generators over 20 megawatts. We've had actually one formal request that submitted an application, and we've also had several inquiries. So. This is something that's going to continue to develop. We'll probably see more formal requests for generation interconnection as clean energy policies really drive development of wind and solar in the state. And even though a party may come in and ask us to interconnect, transmission service, could you go just back one more for me, Rebecca? just wanted to highlight for you that transmission service is separate and distinct from interconnection service. So the entities are coming and talking to us have to submit a separate request for transmission service. It is studied in its own process, and a separate contract is signed for that transmission service. So just because we're studying them to interconnect does not provide them any right to transmission service or guarantee that we will be able to provide that without additional study or cost. Sorry. Thanks, Rebecca. Now we can go to six. So some interconnection agreement highlights. To the extent 90-page agreement on interconnection can have highlights, just wanted to point out a few things for you. That, like all contracts, it's about allocating cost and risk and responsibilities. So the responsibility for designing and procuring and constructing facilities is allocated between the interconnecting party and the district. The funding of that and the funding of any network upgrades is also allocated, as well as operating and maintenance expenses. Quickly, the difference between interconnection facilities and network upgrades. So if someone comes to interconnect and we have lines on our side and lines on their side and a transformer, and those are all our interconnection facilities, that we allocate cost and responsibility for that. Network upgrades are when we have to make improvements to our transmission system apart from the actual equipment used to connect their generator or their load in order to support that interconnection. And so the agreement sets out cost responsibility for those as well. We also have provisions to address cost responsibility between various interconnection customers for shared facilities. So, for example, if we had multiple people asking to connect down in the Malaga area and we could connect them all with one facility, how do we apportion out the cost of that between multiple people? And how do we do that if someone comes up, interconnects, and then shortly after we get a second party, so that we can do it fairly and not shift the burden based on when in time we receive the application. The agreement addresses a number of operational requirements, so data provision from the generator or the load, how we handle outages and service interruptions, how we handle emergencies, and even how we can receive grid reliability support from a generator. And then finally, the agreement addresses how we avoid subsidization of cost or transfer of benefits. This is transfer benefits from district customers to the interconnector for regulatory compliance that should be the responsibility of the interconnection customer. And generally what this refers to is we're seeing requirements for resource adequacy, we're seeing additional environmental compliance requirements. And what we want to ensure is that if somebody comes and interconnects to our system and they would be the party that's supposed to bear that responsibility, or they're the party that's causing us to have an increased obligation, that we've appropriately assigned that obligation to them. So if we had, for example, a large load that comes in and increases our RPS requirements and our CETA requirements, they aren't able to avoid their share of our overall compliance requirements. Next slide, please. So just to wrap up, we have a couple of next steps. As I mentioned, we're going to finalize our template interconnection agreement. It's near final. We're going to give it a good scrub, come back to you to discuss it in more detail and answer any questions you have about it, and then finalize our transmission policies and procedures to bring those back to you by the end of the year and have those put in place as well. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you have on this or related topics.
Commissioners, any questions?
I have a question, just a point of clarification, Rob. Is there such a thing as reaching capacity and having the inability to service an interconnect request, or will we always build out to accommodate that?
That is a great question. There are two pieces of that. One is the interconnection capacity, which and the other is the transmission system capacity. We are talking interconnections today, but I'll address both of them. And the answer is that, yes, we're proposing in our transmission policy and practices package that we would build out. This would be an obligation that the FERC could impose on us through their 211A authority in the transmission service arena, certainly, probably an interconnection service, unless it is for a large load. But we're also allowed to assign cost responsibility for that. So this would not be where we have to take on an obligation to build, but we also have to absorb those costs. So we're able to allocate those on to the interconnector or the system user. There are options for how those are assigned depending on whether, at least in the transmission space, whether we are seeing a system-wide benefit, in which case we can roll those costs into transmission rates and the user pays their share of that, or if the facilities only benefit the new user, then we have the ability to, excuse me, directly assign those facility costs to that user, but then they aren't captured in rates, and so neither the user nor the system are seeing that piece of it in the transmission rates. So to kind of condense and summarize that, yes, we are expecting we would take on that obligation to build that is part of the FERC model, but we would not be exposed to subsidization or pushing costs off to existing users.
Thanks, Rob.
Sure. Any other questions? Well, Rob, I just want to say great presentation, and you really underestimate your ability to keep our attention. I mean, you've got a group of commissioners here that also, you know, gets really engaged with a sewer presentation too. So, but this one, what you're talking about is the big event of what we do and providing power to our customers. So thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah, commissioners, I would like to say thanks to Rob and to Chad Bowman as well, who's put a lot of time and effort into this. These are very controversial issues for other utilities. We are fortunate it hasn't been that way for us so far. But getting in front of this and having policies in place will make it likely that we will not face the kind of challenges that others have faced. So we'll look forward to bringing this to a conclusion later this summer. Okay, next up, we have a legislative update. It was a very active legislative session, so there's quite a few things to cover. Sean Seaman will be leading this, and then we're going to have some input from Tuli Hakala, Melissa Lyons, and Bob Shane along the way of some of the specific issues that came up through the session.
Great. Thank you, Steve, and thank you, commissioners. It was a very busy session, and can we move on forward, Rebecca, please? Basically, just going to talk about the session. We'll go over the bills. And again, this is just your information today. There's no decisions based on today's conversation. Next slide, please. Just a quick overview. It was a 105-day session, so it was the first session of the biennium. I had 53 bills of interest that we watched closely that passed the legislature. We're just going to give you a subset of those today that have more direct impact. We'll say there's about 168 bills I was tracking throughout the session, more over time, but pretty much settled down to that level, but 53 bills of interest, and we'll talk a subset of those today. It was mentioned a busy session, particularly around greenhouse gas emissions, and this is a continuation of the governor's climate commitment in the state. So last year we had the Clean Energy Clean Energy Transformation Act. There was a building efficiency bill of 19. And this year, we're seeing two significant bills with the Climate Commitment Act, or the CAP and Invest bill, along with a low carbon fuel standard. So significant bills related to greenhouse gas emissions. Included in that, though, was this year was we saw woven into numerous bills, but prominently within the cap and trade bill, cap and invest bill, environmental justice components. I'll talk briefly about that when we get to a bill that was passed. We had funding requests in the capital budget, and we'll talk about those here a little bit later. Of note that all bills of interest have been delivered to the governor for signature. Most of them have been signed. There's some signings going on today and tomorrow, and tomorrow's the last day the governor can sign bills before they would go into be enforced, be active without his signature. All bills are effective July 25th of this year, unless we note those in the presentation. Next slide, please, Rebecca. So our priorities, as you recall from last, from previous presentations, were our capital budget funding request. We had the drive and wastewater funding request. That was $1 million of a local community project. This was directly working through Representative Steele. But also there was the $2.49 million grant request that was part of the Centennial Clean Water Fund. We had our request to help with offset the cost of the water-filled turbine, and this was done through $1 million request. It was placed in the Clean Energy Fund, as well as a request to get $300,000 to do a study on a surface second water source for the regional system, and it'd be a surface water study. And then we supported Prochaska Water District need for $1.1 million for a new well. And this would be part of an effort for the PUD to consider consolidation over time. And so that money is coming forward as well. These are all within the capital budget. Now, that assigning of that budget will be tomorrow. We do not anticipate any issues with any of these funding requests. But until the governor signs it, it's still open for any changes by the governor, but we do not anticipate any. So finally, then, the other priorities that we had were the, well, still on that slide, Rebecca, the wildfire legislation. And within that, we had House Bill 1168. This was the DNR, Department of Natural Resources, request bill. This was to address forest restoration, community resilience, and wildfire response. The big issue with this bill was how is it going to be funded? There was many different discussions along the way, but eventually it was decided to fund the next few years right out of the general fund. So it is being fully funded at $125 million per biennium. And then the Wildfire Committee was the extension of the Wildfire Task Force that was from 2019 legislation that the PUD Association promoted and supported to have a task force in conversations with Department of Natural Resources. And this was a bill sponsored by Senator Hawkins, and this was to continue that work. They needed more time to continue working through the discussions with the PUDs, utilities, and DNR. And one thing that was added to this bill was an expansion of this committee to add a little more diverse voices to the conversation. So that bill was signed on May 3rd as well. Next slide, please. So moving on to bills, I'm going to just jump into here for a second, and we'll turn the 5126 over to Tulia in just a bit. But we're going to touch on the cap and invest bill, the low carbon fuel standard bill, and then we'll hit on some hydrogen, the electric vehicle bills. So I think at this point, I'd like to turn the discussion over to Tuli to give you more information on 5126, the cap and invest bill, which will be signed today by the governor. Tuli.
Hi, good morning. How's my audio?
Good.
I'll give Rebecca a moment here to pull up the presentation. Okay, let's move to slide 2. Great. All right, so the Climate Commitment Act is hot off the press, so we're still learning, and we're certainly going to learn a lot more as we move into rulemaking. But today we wanted to provide a very brief overview of the general framework of the legislation, touch on how the electricity sector will be regulated, and then last, we'll provide some predictions on how we think this legislation is going to impact the district. So to start, the Climate Commitment Act sets up a state economy-wide cap and trade program. The Department of Ecology is the lead regulatory agency under the program, and so they will be responsible for establishing a cap on greenhouse gas emissions for the state's largest emitters. And you're subject to this act if in a year you're either emitting or importing at least 25,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. The kind of the key compliance tool under the program will be an allowance. And you can think of an allowance kind of like a pollution permit. So if you are an entity and you either are allocated for free or you purchase one allowance that gives you permission to emit or import one metric ton of carbon dioxide equivalent. The Department of Ecology, the way they set their cap and the way that cap will decline year after year and the way that allowances will be allocated will be done in a way to make sure that the program allows Washington to meet its greenhouse gas targets, which are listed here on the slide. Under the program, some entities, electric utilities, for example, will get their allowances allocated for free by the state, and then other entities will have to purchase them from the state. Sean mentioned that a lot of the bills that passed had environmental justice components to them, and the cap and trade program is a very good example of that. It directs the state to do a environmental justice review for the revenues that the state will collect from selling allowances. And there are other environmental justice components in the bill as well. That's just one example. The program starts in 2023, and so we anticipate that rulemaking is going to start very soon. The Department of Ecology has a lot to do under the program. However, there's a big contingency here. There's language in the legislation that states that compliance obligations won't begin unless the legislature passes a 5-cent gas tax. And so although we'll start the rulemaking, the program, for practical purposes, won't be implemented unless we have that subsequent gas tax legislation. Let's move to the next slide. All right, so for electricity sector regulation, there's kind of two ways that you would be subject to regulation if you're an electric utility. One, you might own or operate in-state emitting generation, or you might be considered an electricity import that's bringing emitting electricity into the state. And I think I mentioned earlier already that electric utilities are some of the entities that will receive free allowances through the program up until 2045. 2045 is significant because that is a important date in CETA, in the Clean Energy Transformation Act. That's the year under CETA where Washington utilities are expected to be 100% clean, and so that alignment between the end of free allowances in 2045 aligns with that CETA target. The legislation directs that free allowances are going to be allocated to utilities to mitigate the cost burden that the program creates for their customers. That concept of cost burden is going to be very important as we move into rulemaking. It's a concept that we borrowed from California. Our understanding of how that works is you would receive allowances for both direct costs of the program. So, for example, if you do own or operate in-state emitting generation or you're importing emitting generation into the state, you would be required to retire allowances to meet those emissions subject to the statewide cap that I mentioned. And so that would be a direct cost, the cost of those allowances. An indirect cost would be, even if you are not a directly regulated entity in that you're not retiring allowances, you may be paying more for electricity that you're using to serve your customers, because we'll now have a carbon price factored into the price of electricity. So we anticipate that through rulemaking, we will further develop that concept of cost burden. And we know from the legislation that a utility's cost burden will be based on their load and resource forecast. There isn't much verbiage in the legislation that talks about how CETA and this new cap and trade program will work together. But our understanding is that for electric utilities, if you are meeting your CETA requirements, so you're net zero by 2030, 100% clean by 2045, and then on an appropriate trajectory, you know, to get to 2030 and then getting to 2045, that you would be allocated free allowances in a manner that aligns with whatever emissions are allowable under CETA. If a utility receives allowances, they could retire them for compliance. They could also sell them. If they do choose to sell them, then the legislation directs that the utility needs to use the proceeds for the benefit of their customers, and rate impacts to low-income customers have to be prioritized, or mitigating rate impacts to low-income customers needs to be prioritized. Let me pause there. I've been talking a lot. Before I jump to potential impacts to the district, any questions or comments so far on the general program or how the electric sector will be regulated?
Commissioners, any questions? I think you can proceed.
Okay, let's move to slide 4. Right, so potential impacts to the district. So based on our current trading and our resource portfolio, we would not be a covered entity, meaning we would not have an obligation to retire allowances. We don't own any in-state emitting generation, and we wouldn't be considered a electricity importer. The rules for who is and isn't an electricity importer are they're a little bit complicated, but the general premise is that if you are the entity that's transmitting electricity over state lines, then you would be an electricity importer responsible for the emissions associated with that import. Since we buy our power directly at Mid-C and that's located within the state of Washington, we would not trigger that requirement. The next point, we talked about this earlier during the energy planning and trading quarterly report. We are seeing a number of factors, regulatory, you know, market, that are driving an increase in demand for our hydropower. We think this cap and invest program is going to contribute to that. We also anticipate that starting in 2023, we're going to see a carbon price in wholesale energy traded in Washington. So we'll see likely a carbon price at Mid-C. And again, 2023 is the date that the cap and invest program starts. And then last, another impact that we anticipate seeing is that we might see some interest by sellers and buyers to create a new product or perhaps more than one new product at Mid-C because of the cap and invest program. There are transactions that happen at Mid-C that either pass through Washington and sink in another state, or perhaps don't pass through Washington at all. And so there might be interest in having products that differentiate between whether the transaction has a Washington cap and invest obligation or not. Okay, I will, I'll pause there again, and that's the last slide I have, so any questions or comments there?
Commissioners, questions? think you can keep moving.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Tilly. So Rebecca will be bringing up my presentation again. This is Sean. And we'll stay on that same slide five, Rebecca.
Well, by the way, I didn't mean, Julie, that was an interesting presentation. Before I thought you had more to go, and when I said to keep moving, I didn't mean to dismiss you whatsoever, but good presentation. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much.
And Julie, I hope you can stay on just in case something comes up later today with this presentation. Thank you.
Sure.
So we're going to move on then to the next suite of bills are related to electric vehicles or electrification of transportation. So 1091 is a low carbon fuel standard. This is a bill that's been in the works for a number of years. This has been promoted by Representative Fitzgibbon for a number of years. It is being signed today as part of a suite of signing. This one is a big fundamental change. It's basically going to work towards electrification of transportation. It'll put a price on the carbon, if you will, for the fuel for the transportation sector. So it's aiming to reduce emissions targets or reduce emissions from the sector, the transportation sector. And there's a couple of key points I wanted to talk about. First of all, just due to the interest of the ag industry in our area, ag fuels will be exempted from this program, but only through January 1st of 2028. There's some other exemptions, but for us, that's the one in this area that would be impacted. And there's also a connection. I'm not really sure yet how this is going to work with the cap and trade. And there's some other fuels issues in there. So I think stay tuned for rulemaking and how they're going to link these different bills, particularly when they hit similar areas such as fuels. The utilities can participate in the low carbon fuel standard. So the whole idea is if you're an emitter, you're going to be having to acquire credits for that emission, similar to the cap and trade bill. But we as utilities can generate credits, and we do that through actual sales of electricity for residential EV charging, but also throughout the bill, there's some other processes that a generator or electric utilities and others can generate credits, for instance, through the use of DC or supporting DC fast chargers. There's so much in this bill that has to be worked out in rules. So, for instance, the idea that utilities can generate credits is a three-line section, a subsection. That's all it says, that utilities can generate credits through this process of residential EV charging. So much detail on how that's going to happen and what and how that will be worded, et cetera, to be done through rules. So very complicated bill, a lot of work to be done through rules, and this is going to be done through Ecology, who is the primary lead agency on this bill. So what's interesting for utilities, there's a section on Section 9 of the bill talks about any of the revenues from these credits that we generate. Half the proceeds would have to go directly towards utilities spending those in ways that we like to, but some guidance around expanding and extending electrification of transportation. The money has to go back that a utility gets somehow towards supporting or directly supporting EVs and electric transportation electrification. So the second 50% of the proceeds that utility would get would have to be spent on types of programs and projects unless it's going to be developed by Ecology and the Department of Transportation. This section, Section 9, went through multiple changes and was actually changed on the floor at the last possible moment to a form that utilities felt we could live with. The changes that were so important for the utilities that some of the earlier language would not have been acceptable or even good for the state and how it was the funding would have been used. But so keep in mind, 50% of the funding of a utility participates goes right back into doing certain transportation electrification based on what we think was possible or reasonable for us. And the second 50% is going to be guided based on a program list developed by Ecology and Transportation. What's the other part of this bill, though, is that it allows for aggregators, those who can go and collect unused credits that are generated. So let's say a utility does not participate, doesn't want to. It's a voluntary program. If we don't want to participate in this and become a credit generator, then aggregators can come in and take the unused credits wherever they are in the state. And there's not a lot of detail on that in the bill other than it sets up this idea of aggregators. So that's something for utilities to keep in mind as they decide whether or not they want to participate in this program.
Sean?
Yes.
Would we have here at Chelan any idea what magnitude of dollars we're talking about if we were to become a participant?
Great question, Commissioner. At this point, we do not have enough information to even know what that looks like yet. For instance, how much we do know, for one thing, that our energy that we would supply is very clean. And so there's actually, I call it a sliding scale for electric utilities. They'll go in and look at each utility and value how many credits would you get for the energy we're using. Since we're using predominantly our clean hydro sources, we may get a higher value of more credits, if you will, versus a utility that has a more diverse portfolio, has a little more carbon resources in their mix. So they're going to think about, through the rules, how clean is your source of electricity being used to fuel these vehicles, and therefore a little more value for a very clean resource. But not enough information yet, Commissioner, to understand what that looks like for us as far as value.
Thank you.
Before I move, I'm going to go off onto the next bills. Is there anything on the low carbon fuel standard that we can address while I'm on that subject right now? Very good. The other electric vehicle bills, the hydrogen bill, Senate Bill 5000, this again was sponsored by Senator Hawkins. And this basically sets up a pilot project to an 8-year pilot program for, they're calling them fuel cell powered vehicles, that those vehicles would also get the sales and use tax breaks. It's similar to the other electric vehicles. So it just added fuel cell vehicles to the list of the vehicles to get the tax break. It's just an 8-year project at this point, pilot project. 1287 was just some language trying to prepare setting up some standards and some language within statute to just sort of prepare for more zero emission vehicles in the future. What was interesting about this bill, it had a partial veto. There was a section that would have required, if certain things happen, if there was a certain penetration of vehicles that had signed up instead of on a gas tax, but actually signed up for a mileage fee based on a fee to the state based on how many miles they traveled as opposed to a gas tax. If there was a certain number of those vehicles signed up, then by 2030, the state would require all vehicles to be electric. The governor vetoed that section, so that's no longer part of this bill. 5192 was strictly related to trying to get standardization for charging infrastructure, EV charging infrastructure. There's no standards in the state right now, and the state wanted to have this be more aligned with like gas pumps. And so this was a program that would also be administered by the Department of Ag and apply similar rules and regulations as they do with gas pumps, the standardization, information on the charging stations so that customers and users understand the cost and other rules and regulations associated with using a charging station. So before I move on, I just wanted to note that these bills are sort of, and with CETA previously and some other electric vehicle bills in the past, this is a very large component of the governor's Climate Commitment Act, as I talked about. We had CETA from a couple years ago, the Capital Invest Bill, the Low Carbon Fuel Standard Bill, more electric vehicle bills. The one thing that was missing now is building electrification. There was a bill that did not pass. It would have dealt with and addressed building electrification. Whether that comes again back next year, that bill could be back next year. All bills will be in play again next year, but will it be a push is unknown at this point. So I would say that the governor over his tenure has pushed for and seen a large component to have his climate agenda has been achieved this year. So move on to next slide, please. So I'm going to touch briefly on a couple of issues with the telecom bills and then turn this over to Bob Shane in just a bit. But the two bills, 1336, and this is an unrestricted retail authority bill for PUDs. If you read George Kahn's announcement on this, you have some background on this. This was signed May 13, and that bill took out struck the safe harbor language, but we no longer needed that safe harbor language with full retail authority. But the second bill, the first bill, 1336, was Representative Drew Hansen, and the second bill, 5383, was Senator Wellman. And this was a more restricted retail authority bill. It was for unserved areas only, and it retained our safe harbor language within the same section of statute that was struck with the 1336. But, and Bob may get in a little more detail, and I apologize if I'm jumping ahead of you, Bob, but this was retail, unserved areas defined as an area that was 100 by 20, 100 megabytes of speed download and 20 upload, which is a pretty high level. It means there's a lot of unserved areas in the state. Before I jump into Bob's presentation, I just want to mention $411 million of funding to get more broadband out there in the state in the capital budget. Of note, $326 million of that is going to go to the state broadband office, and how they're going to get that money out still to be decided and be determined. But $60 million to the Public Works Board for their grant and loan program, and $25 million to CURB with the Community Economic Revitalization Board. So I want to turn this over to Bob at this point to give you a little more background on what these two bills, 1336 and 5383, will mean to Chelan PUD. And with that, over to Bob.
Thank you, Sean. Commissioners, Bob Shane, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom. First, I'd like to recognize all the hard work that district staff and WAPUTA members and legislators put together to really reach this significant accomplishment. I think back a couple of years, the conversations around this were never really even serious, because that wall we had to get over was so darn difficult that it's amazing we got to this point. So I just wanted to throw that out there. In general, having retail authority will definitely provide new opportunities for the district and how we operate our business, obviously to ultimately improve our abilities to better serve our customer owners. And through our strategic planning processes, we'll consider and incorporate the changes as a result of what we're seeing here as this retail authority. But I don't want to get a lot of detail, but I would like to cover, I think, four key takeaways when we look at this full authority provision that we have. First and foremost, it doesn't pose any risk to our current broadband program. So if you'll recall, we operate under the wholesale model. And through a partnership with our service providers, we deliver a very cost-competitive broadband service to our customer owners. We don't see that changing at this point. Under this model, it keeps operational costs to a minimal through shared responsibilities, and we believe we provide the best balanced and efficient approach in delivering the full suite of services that we currently provide here to our customer owners. As Sean has mentioned, we do effectively gain a safe harbor provision that was really key to the fiber business unit. If you recall, our concern was if we had a service provider fail to meet our expectations, we are pretty limited in what we could do to resolve that. But with full authority, we could, if we needed, to step in and provide that broadband service to our customer owners. We believe there's some enhanced outreach that we can do through this full retail authority through direct education and marketing to our end users. And in doing that, I think we can increase our subscriber take rate and reduce our churn on our systems. We'll continue to work with our providers to increase what I want to call brand awareness. Chelan PUD is very proud of what we do, and our customer owners are. I think we'd like to escalate that or move that to the next level of recognition within our counties. Surprisingly, I still get calls from customers who don't realize that Chelan PUD is providing a broadband system. So that's always interesting to me to think that we've been doing it for so long, and yet there are people out there that are not aware of it, probably newer residents coming to the area, so we can work on that. And really develop a really focused effort to target the needs and expectations of our customer owners through this retail authority. There are some possible new federal funding opportunities. Don't fully understand that at this point. We're still looking into it, but it does look like we will have some, because we can do retail, we are probably going to have some broadened qualifications or meet some broader qualifications for some type of federal funding. We don't know exactly what that is right now, but we are looking at that. A point of clarity, I do want to mention that being a retail authority does not provide us does not define us as eligible telecommunication carrier. You heard us talk about ETC status. That was a provision in some of the federal funding. You had to have that status before you could receive federal funds. Retail authority does not grant that to us. That's just something that's separate apart from that. I wanted to make that clear. So we'll continue to work with the state broadband office and federal agencies to see what type of broadband funding is available to us now under this retail authority provision. Going forward, we'll continue to operate under the wholesale model. We'll incorporate elements of the retail authority provision that makes sense to us. The ones that I just mentioned are likely the ones we're going to incorporate. We'll further evaluate the benefits and risks in operating as a full retail service provider with plans to return to the board in Q3 with an update if that meets your expectations. It's pretty high level, but I didn't want to get a lot of detail, but I'm more than happy to answer any questions that you might have at this time. Otherwise, I'll turn it back to Sean.
I'll wait to see if there's any questions before I continue.
Commissioners, any questions? Thank you, Bob. I know it was quite a journey through legislature this year, and a lot of people did a lot of heavy lifting, and the outcome was very, very successful. So thank you to both of you. And
your team. You're welcome.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. Just the last couple of things on these two bills before I move on. I'll be able to get through the rest of my presentation fairly quickly after this. But 1336 did have a small section vetoed. It did not impact our retail authority. It was related to local governments that were subject to GMA and availability of funds, and the governor just struck that. So no impact on us, but so you know, there was a veto to that, a partial veto. The other thing that's really interesting and turning out to be complicated is the fact that these are conflicting bills. As I mentioned, they both modified or amended statute differently. So the same, both bills, same language or same statute, different language. And they were both signed on the same day, and so that there was an understanding that it's the last bill that gets to filed by the Secretary of State might take precedent. But it's not, we're understanding of information I'm getting today, it may not be that clear. So we will know a lot more about this soon, how this is going to be reconciled at the state level, at the Secretary of State level, and we'll be back to you when we have more information on that. It's a very interesting development with those two bills. So next slide, please. I'm just going to touch briefly on all these. The human resources safety issues we watch as well, as you well know. There was just a couple of these amendments to the paid family medical leave. One was to address the eligibility based on people and the amount of hours they were able to work during COVID and expanded that for a small period of time. That was 1073, 5097, changed the definition of family such that more employees, could be eligible for paid family medical leave program. The definition changed quite a bit to a point where it was better, but not what I think business would think was great, but a better definition than they started earlier in the session. Worker protection 1097 and the other one 5115, the health emergency labor standards were both associated with response to the COVID pandemic. The last one, 1323, this is the state developed a program a couple of years ago for long-term care, which employees will enter into. There's an opportunity to opt out if you had long-term care through other means. And the state is moving that date up to November 1st of this year. The thought process there is that they're going to push this on people and try to get it basically such that they can get more people to be into this program if they shorten the date when you can sign up to opt out. It used to be December 31st of 2022, and they've moved that date up to November 1st of this year. So that's something that we'll working with HR knows about this and have to communicate this with our employees. Next slide, please. There was just, amazingly enough, only a couple of water bills this year. In years past, we've had many water bills. This year, pretty minimal. 1443 is a pilot program. It's taking place in Walla Walla. It's just it's a pilot program for water rights banking to be put into trust. And we're watching this one as a precedent setting to see how that goes with ecology and that whole process. 1184 was just requiring Department of Health to develop rules around the use of gray water for certain non-potable issues. So that's something that we may or may not have interest in, just one that we watched and happy to see that one passed. Next slide, please. This is my last slide about just other bills. 1446 was a bill that was promoted by Calais PD along with Waputa. They did a very great job of getting this one through. It basically allowed a process to avoid penalties under the Energy Independence Act. If a force majeure issue. In this case, there was concern that due to COVID that some utilities might miss their conservation targets. And this would provide relief from penalties if that happened going forward, not just for COVID, but for any force majeure issue as defined by the change. 1368 was passed early in the session, and this was just about some of the federal funding going to note for us available for rental assistance and utility bills signed all the way back to February 19th. The 5141 we talked about earlier in association with the cap and invest bill, the environmental justice. This particular bill is enacting the recommendations of the environmental task force from a couple of years ago. Most of the work, and I should say the bill itself is geared towards state agencies and considering environmental justice in their actions and their policies. But the of note here is that there's a strong connection between the cap and invest bill and this bill, since this bill, 5141, establishes Environmental Justice Council, and that council has a prominent role in how some of the funding or the proceeds from the cap and invest bill will be spent towards advancing environmental justice causes. So not a direct impact to us as the PD under many actions of this bill, but we don't know yet how some of the actions of agencies to address environmental justice will roll down and the downstream effects on agencies and local governments such as the PD. So more information on that as it becomes clear. Last couple of bills I had, the 5032, this one was just to extend some of the alternative public works contracting mechanisms that were put into place. They were getting set to sunset, and that's why the bill went into effect immediately upon signing in on May 10th. This is things such as general contractor, construction manager, or the design build alternative public work contracting that we've been using and other utilities and other public works agencies want to use. And the last bill I had was 5063, and this is involving the Invasive Species Council, and just reauthorized the council for 10 years. And I have a really glad to see this one. As a member of the Invasive Species Council, I see the value of the council and the important work they're doing, and we're really pleased to see that the state recognized that and reauthorized their existence for another 10 years. So finally, before moving to questions. I just wanted to give a thanks to, really note a thanks to Representative Mike Steele in his role. I mentioned it before, but his role in all those budget requests and his role as a ranking member on capital budget was key to, I think, our success in those funding, getting those funds in the budget. So with that, I will turn it over to any questions.
Commissioners, any questions? There's a lot going on, Sean. Thank you.
Well, there's a lot of rulemaking that's going to take place over the next couple of years, and staff will be steeped in that to make sure that we see some very good rules beneficial to utilities. So more on that as we go through the process over the next few years.
Gary, do you have a question?
Sean, I did. Thank you, Randy. Sean, back on 1323, which is the long-term care bill.
Yes.
Is that, am I to understand that, I haven't read that bill yet, that is traditional long-term care after employment, is that correct?
Well, this is similar.
Can you go into detail just a little bit more?
It's more of a similar, if you ended up needing long-term care, and similar with the program that is available to Chelan PUD employees, you get, there's a set amount of money. In this case is that I think the state's limit is about $30,000 as a lifetime program for if you need that for long-term care. So this was a bill that passed a couple of years ago. We pay into it as employees, and the employers pay into it. There's a trust that's developed to help that you can draw from. And you can opt out. We as employees can opt out if we have a long-term care program available to us. But again, they're moving that up to November 1st of this year, and the rationale is they want to limit a number of people basically that will sign up for that.
Sure.
That option. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for that clarification, Sean. Appreciate it.
Any other questions for Sean? Steve, we have 2 minutes. We have a few minutes. You want to do some manager items?
I would like to, yes. We have some folks online to do that. Let me start with Neil Narazos on an update on Rock Island facilities dedication.
Good morning, Commissioners. Neil Narazos, Communications Manager. I want to give you an update and mainly a heads up on an event we have coming up in June, on June 17th. If you've been down to Rock Island, you've seen the great work that's going on down there. It's really exciting to see the facilities taking shape. As you know, those will house a lot of different work down there, the hydro crews, the engineers, broad range of other work going on down there. We'd like to have a smaller event on June 17th that we can be comprised of the PD Commission, senior team, the project team, and contractors. We'd have a short introduction from potentially Commissioner Smith, and then dedicate the facility. We'd have some touring opportunities, and then later this summer, we would have our staff out to that site. So really exciting work, and I can take any questions at this point.
Questions for Neil? Looking forward to it. It's been, how many years have we been building down there?
Boy, I don't know, at least a couple, Steve.
A lot.
But yeah, just some beautiful facilities. One of the things I really like about it is it really supports our strategic priority of investing in assets and people. So
yeah.
I think you'll be really excited to see it when you get a chance to get down there.
It's a big day.
It's more to come.
Neil, can you give me that date again?
Yes, it would be 9:30 to 11 a.m. on Thursday, June 17th. And I think Rebecca's got
Thank
it on
you.
The calendars as a placeholder.
Thank you. I don't see it on my calendar yet, but I'll put it on there. Thank you.
Okay. I would like to move to Carrie Wendell, who has a couple of updates, one of which is the COVID-19 customer impacts.
Good morning, Commissioners. Carrie Wendell, Customer Relations Manager. I'm here to give you another customer update related to the COVID impacts. So, Can you hear me?
We can hear you good. Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that. So our outreach efforts continue with results similar to the prior month. We're seeing that the door hangers have increased effectiveness in either receiving payment or identifying customers that need assistance. And we're seeing also that those referred to community action have received payment support. As the moratorium expiration approaches, which is scheduled for July 30th, guidelines regarding customer programs are being developed and recommended by WAPUTA. And when we know more, we will shift our outreach message and internal processes accordingly or as desired by the commission management. We hope to be able to inform you of these plans at the next monthly update, but if you have things you'd like to consider, please let me know. Next slide. Thanks, Rebecca. So the past due residential accounts continue a steady climb, about 15,000 increase from last month. And that total represents about 0.5% of our annual residential revenues. Next slide. The Helping Hand distribution went up a little bit this month. Currently, Helping Hand is mainly used to fill the gap between the energy assistance programs and the account balances. So this may be an indicator that customers eligible for the energy assistance have already exhausted those benefits, and now we're starting to see that Helping Hand account being leveraged a little bit more. Next slide. So the energy assistance, consistent with last year, the average per customer is back up, and we continue to refer our customers to the community action programs. There's also some new programs that are related to rental assistance that also provides utility payment support. So we're looking forward to seeing how these benefits will help our customers. And let's see, any questions up to this point? Sorry, I probably went too fast. You guys have all seen this presentation before, so.
So Carrie, I know that you reached out to Community Action recently because the amounts in arrearage have been rising, just to see how they're doing in terms of getting some of those dollars from the state out. Can you speak to that?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that? I couldn't hear you very well.
Yeah, speaking through a mask.
Sorry.
So I understand that you've reached out to Community Action recently just to talk about the ramp up of their program, because we continue to see the arrearages grow, and yet we know there's more dollars available. Can you speak to that? How they're doing?
Sure. Yeah, it sounds like that they, they have more funds available. There's a couple new programs that they're leveraging at this point, and a lot of rental support. And they're working through some of those requirements, and they should know more here in the next month or so. But it sounds like there's going to be a lot of funds still available through the rest of the year.
And my takeaway from our earlier conversation is lots of regulations to go with it that they have to work through, so they're in a ramp-up phase right now.
Mm-hmm. So, Gary, you had a question?
Thank you, Randy. Carrie, just on your door hangers on the previous slide, there were 31 no responses. I'm assuming the door hangers were in a dual language?
Yes, Commissioner. Our meter readers have been delivering door hangers, and when they deliver those out to the customers, we keep track of how many of them actually get a hold of us and respond or make a payment. And that small group, usually about half of them don't respond. So I think one of the things to keep in mind is that WAPUTA, I had a meeting last week with the customer service group, and they believe that once that moratorium expires, that we're going to start getting some responses from those customers that see that that's being lifted. So that may help get a little bit more. Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So
then
Carrie,
I just have one. Go ahead.
Well, a question that came to my mind that I'm pretty certain you won't have the answer to is, with the number of customers that we have that are behind and the numbers that are now going up, does anybody have, other than us, have a way to measure which ones truly will qualify for the additional assistance?
I'm not sure, Commissioner, on that one. It seems that most of the customers that we are referring to Community Action are receiving help. So hopefully that's the case with them once they start responding and we can get them help.
Yeah, I worry about those that don't qualify that have just maybe taken an opportunity not to pay their bill.
Mm-hmm. I think there will be those, but, we're open to working with them with some payment arrangements. And then when those guidelines come out, that'll help us as we move forward with those processes and how we'll take care of them.
And just to clarify, Commissioners, what happened last week was the Washington UTC told the IOUs that the moratorium would come off on July 31st. But at this point, the proclamation that goes along with that from the governor's office is still enforced through then. So we're waiting to see what will happen out of the governor's office before we would know its applicability to consumer-owned utilities.
That's correct.
Any other
questions? I also wanted to add, what was that?
Go ahead.
I just wanted to add one thing is we're planning a group meeting on June 15th with the customer relations group, and we'll be closing down our phones from 2 to 5, and we're hoping to have some of those guidelines from the state on customer repayment programs and disconnect late fee rules so that we can train staff on those programs, as well as other projects that are coming up, like the payment kiosks and AMI. So just wanted to give you a heads up on that we're looking at that coming up in the next few weeks as well.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, it appears that we are at noon, and so I think we should break for lunch, take a recess, come back at 1 o'clock, and pick up on our afternoon session. See you back here in an hour. Good afternoon, and welcome to the afternoon session of the May 17, 2021 Public Utility District Commission meeting. We met this morning in study session. This afternoon is a business session. I'd like to welcome everybody to this virtual meeting and remind people that to leave your computers or iPads on mute when you're not speaking to avoid excess noise on the meeting. All commissioners are present. All of our normal staff are present. If there's anybody on the call that wishes to address any item on the agenda this afternoon that is part of the public, could you speak now? Hearing nobody, if there's anybody on the call that is wishing to speak to the commission for any other item, we will have an opportunity at the end of the meeting for you to have public input. So with that being said, the first item on our afternoon agenda is our consent agenda. And this morning, our consent agenda was modified to include agenda items 10 and 11. Is there a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So moved. I make such motion.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is carried. The consent agenda has been approved. So I'm going to hand it off to Steve Wright. I think we're up to resolution number 12.
That's right. A resolution amending the criteria used for qualifying low-income persons and procedural requirements for waiver of electric service connection fees as defined in resolutions 95-10274 and 99-11190. Lindsay Mons and Kathy Melton will be presenting.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. This is Lindsay Mons. I believe Kathy's on the line as well if you have any specific questions for her, but I'll take the bulk of it this afternoon. I have just a couple short slides for you, really just describing the information that's in the resolution itself. I believe Rebecca's pulling those up now. Thank you, Rebecca. So this program is our low-income housing program service connection fee waiver. And Rebecca, if you'd move to slide 3, I think we've covered our purpose today as well. Just a reminder for the board and anyone that's listening, this is a program that's specific to service connection fees for homes that are purchased by low-income homebuyers from 501c3 organizations. So those are our local housing organizations like Upper Valley Mend, Chelan Valley Trust, Columbia Valley Affordable Housing and Habitat for Humanity, and any others that might come in the future. This is a program that the district has had for quite some time, since 1995. However, we have done a review this year in 2021 at the request of the board. Rebecca, if you can move to our next slide, please. Our recommendation today that you've heard some information about at the last few board meetings is basically summarized in this table. The new program or new, I guess we could call it a new program, the revised program, there we go. We would continue to have this program for single family residents up to 200 amps, which is the same as our existing program. And in this program, the line extension fees, which has been a question of the board in the past, those would continue to be paid by the builder as well. The changes that we're proposing for the revised program are primarily in the income limit and then some of the other registration programs that we have with it. So first on the housing program income limit, our current policy is 150% of the federal poverty level. We would recommend moving towards what the state has proposed in their CETA Clean Energy Transformation Act information. Their definition of low income is 80% of average median income or area median income. This area median income actually comes from information published or collected through the census. So the HUD's Office of Policy Development and Research develops the area median incomes based on the census that are then escalated on CPI based on the number of years it's been since the census was performed. For our area, the information that was collected is from the Wenatchee area. So we have one area median income that applies countywide, but is based on information from Wenatchee. I'll pause there because I know there had been some board questions on that.
Any questions, board members?
Okay, hearing none there. And just an FYI on that 80% area median income, that's approximately equal to 200% of the federal poverty level. So if you're looking for a comparison number of how our policy is changing, it's essentially going from 150% to 200% of the FPL. Some of the other program requirements that were part of this in the past include equal pay enrollment, and we're proposing removing that requirement and using our existing policies and process there. Our equal pay program is set up based on the prior year's energy usage and cost, so we really felt that this had a potential to set customers up potentially for a challenge because we don't know what their monthly bills are going to look like in these new homes. And if we estimate that to be too low, we could get to the end of the year and they have a large account balance owing. Or on the flip side, collect too much from them each month and then you know, that equal pay just doesn't quite work out until we have that 1 year of historical data. So they would continue to be eligible for our equal pay program, which is an excellent program. However, we would not require it under this policy. And then the other change would be in the security deposits. So they're under current policy, these customers would be exempt from security deposits. We're proposing removing that as well and using our regular policy and process. For residential customers like this, the deposit, if they don't have payment history with the district, is $100. And these customers do still have the opportunity for support there. That is one of the things that they can apply for through Community Action Council and our Helping Hands program. So while it's not waived internally, they can receive support for helping pay that security deposit. And that is just a deposit. So that $100 they would get back after their period of good payment history. And then the final bullet there, just policy location. Instead of having it in a resolution that the board has to revise anytime the program changes, we would include it in utility services policy, which are also governed by the board, and any changes come before the board. But we do have a standard process for that that we would include this within. So that was a quick rundown of changes. And I do just want to point out one thing. On the income limit, it is a program level income limit. And Rebecca, if you could get me to the next slide. What that really means is when these housing programs are applying for a fee waiver, they actually don't know who's going to purchase the home. So when we review eligibility under this, under our program, we look at the housing program's income limit. So for example, there, the Upper Valley Mend qualifications are the 80% of area median income. So that's all the further we would look as to whether or not this particular home build qualifies. We don't follow through their whole process to find out who actually purchased the home and what their income is, because these programs do follow their own policies. We rely on them in that way. So I just want to make sure that was clear. Based on some previous questions, it sounded like perhaps it was not. So I will pause there again if there are any questions for me today or other clarifications or information you would like.
Any questions, commissioners?
Commissioners, might add one thought that if a not-for-profit had a program that qualified people at higher than that level, that doesn't mean they're excluded from our program. They would just have to have a program that meets our level that qualifies. So they might have a subset program, in other words, that would qualify for the ability to participate in our program.
Yes, thank you, Steve. Somehow I looked right over that on my bullets notes for today. That is correct.
No questions? Do we want to handle 12 and 13 as one item or two different items?
So this is Steve, Randy.
Yes.
I can't see your slides. So Lindsay, are you finished with the presentation? Are we going with comments or just questions at this point on anything you've covered? Are you continuing?
No, I am actually complete. Thank you.
Oh, okay, great. Well, I do have a comment. So I'm in support of doing this because I've seen firsthand the benefit to improving the quality of life in many, many people in several different communities. When we have service workers who support our businesses in town, and that could include what we found up here in Leavenworth, nurses, teachers, grocery workers, you name it, food service folks, they really struggled to live in the community that they're working in. And by in, making this investment that these nonprofit organizations are promoting, you know, we're participating in offering a quality of life where people that work in their community can live in their community, can shop in their community, can go to school in their communities. Just having the ability of people that live in the community attend their local school where they work, it's really a big deal, and it's quite impressive. I've had the opportunity to visit such places like Sun Valley, Idaho, where the community really doesn't exist anymore. People, you know, the billionaires have pushed out the millionaires. The service providers live in communities that are several towns away. The businesses, for example, Sun Valley Ski Resort, they make housing, kind of an apartment building for their employees. But nobody can even live in the town that they're working. And so to me, this is really fits right in within our mission statement, enhancing the quality of life in our communities. It's protecting the quality of life in our communities. And I think this is one small part that we really, it's really something that we can do, and it's an investment that we make over time. And when those houses are sold to the next individual that comes in and buys them, the original homeowner can make a profit, but it can only be according to the calculation of the increase that they're allowed to see, including the investments that they make in their house. So it really incentivizes the individuals to take care of their homes, to invest in their homes, and again, the quality of life in the community is enhanced. So I'm a big supporter of this, as you can tell, and I just appreciate everybody's effort to consider this. Thank you.
Any other comments? Recognizing we've only got two items, I'd be open to fielding a motion to pass this one, and then we can talk about capital budget revisions. Is there a motion to approve resolution 12?
Randy, this is Ann.
Yes.
Sorry, I was on mute. I discovered I was on mute. I have a little different view of this, as happens, but I've spent a lot of time. I've talked to Lindsay. I've spent time with Eric Walquist. I've spent time with Steve talking about this very thing, trying to understand it, trying to understand what's in place right now, what would change. I totally understand the change. We go from 60% area median income, which is what we're supporting right now. We've had this in place since 95, 99. Actually, it was changed. We would slightly change that, but I guess it is a small thing, but I guess my issue is that we, the PUD, I just struggle with what our mission is and what our vision is, and it is to do the best for the most, you know, people, and that includes everybody in the county, right? So, you know, I feel like we are not a social services agency, and we can't guarantee that people can live in the community where they work. And I see it in Chelan. I've seen it in Sun Valley. I've seen it in Jackson Hole. But I think it's far more related to and would be affected far more by tax laws. It has everything to do with the taxes. That's why people can't live in the city of Chelan. So, you know, I, for one, I am happy to just sit with what we have on the books right now. We're at 60%. I just don't want to see that to continue to creep up. Just trying to hold the line on what our real mission is, what our real role is as a public utility district.
Okay. So now that I've allowed both Ann and Steve to talk before there's a motion on the floor, anybody else wish to comment? I've abused Robert's rules.
Well, first of all, Randy, I don't think you've abused Robert's rules. We're having a discussion. There is no motion, and then there's still time for discussion.
Okay.
So I think two things. First of all, I would like to support Steve McKenna's position. Secondly, where I think it falls in with our current strategic plan, two things. During the last outreach to create the strategic plan, one of the things that rose pretty highly was for the PUD to find ways to enhance the economic development in Chelan County. And because of the way the RCWs cause us to be structured, there aren't many opportunities to do so. I see this as a opportunity to fulfill what our customer owners indicated during the strategic plan outreach for us to do. And then I think it falls most directly under the position we've also taken that part of our mission is to enhance the quality of life in Chelan County. And so, although I don't see us as a social agency, we are the base of every basically social program in Chelan County. And regardless if it supports people living in the community where they work, or if they live in another part of the county, to have a quality home to move into that is affordable certainly enhances the quality of life for those people while living in Chelan County. So I see the strategic plan and that segment of what it is we're doing as an enhancement to the quality of life, and just feel it's a place where we can contribute. And so there, I guess I would conclude my statement there.
Okay. Any comments, Gary?
Not really. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this topic. I would say that I am in support of this motion, or soon to be motion, and I would leave it at that.
Okay. So now I'll call for, is there a motion to approve Resolution 12?
I'd make such a motion.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve Resolution 12. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
Nay.
The motion is carried 4-1.
Okay, thank you, commissioners. We'll move now to agenda item 13, which is a capital budget revision. I'll read the entire motion here. This is a proposed motion to establish a $1.2 million fiber system project budget, for PPB fiber expansion in the Dry Lake area of Manson, FTD 178, via transfer from previously established general PPB fiber expansion budget, NWPB 0001, and to increase the 2021 project budget for distribution system fiber build-out make-ready work, DSXX0024, by $900,000, for a revised total 2021 project budget of $1.65 million and to decrease other distribution project budgets for 2021 by the same amount, enabling a shift in spending between capital projects with no change to the overall 2021 distribution capital budget. John Stoll will be speaking to this, I believe, or Lindsay, I'm not sure.
Happy to say a few things. This is Lindsay Montz. Yes, so this budget revision really took root last year when the board approved acceleration of the fiber build-out expansion areas. There's been a joint project team of fiber and distribution working on the remaining areas since then. And this is the current focus is in the Dry Lake area of Manson. As we've been performing make-ready work, which is really those pole replacements and other necessary things to make the existing system structurally sound for attaching fiber. As we've been performing that work, we've identified some areas where we can have some efficiencies and get started on some of the fiber work as well. So requesting this budget revision to establish the fiber project budget so that we can begin doing that work at the same time.
Are there any questions for Lindsay?
I have a question, and that's looking at this picture, Lindsay. There's a green line. What does that green line signify?
I'm going to take a tiny step outside my area of expertise, and if I'm wrong, Bob, please correct me, but I believe those are the borders of the specific fiber distribution tower, 178.
Lindsay, that's a perfect explanation.
So I guess my next question here then is, we're not discussing building out into that entire boxed green area. We're just discussing, as you pointed out, along the Green Lake area, right?
Commissioner, so let me help you through that. So the green area simply is a polygon that helps contain the number of subscribers that in that particular tower. You hear us talk about an FTT or tower. So that defines the geographical area. The actual fiber build will only go to those areas that currently have customers that are living there, established there. We will not be building out to areas where there is no premises or people located.
Thank you. And I appreciate that. And the source of the question was, I'm somewhat familiar with Roses Lake, and I know that on the far side where the green line goes, I think there's only one or two houses on that side of the lake. So I just wanted to make sure that we weren't building to that small population at this time.
Well, part of our process, we look at each and every premises within an FDT, and we make a determination if it's cost effective to go there or not. So it's not a wholesale build everywhere. There's criteria that we apply to make sure that we're making prudent decisions. So there could be an area where a few homes are off the road quite a ways, and it's just too darn expensive to build them, and we will make an exception and exclude them from that PPB build.
Great. Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome.
So, Bob, this is Dennis. So FDT 178, the 178 is the number of premises that we will actually pass. Is that correct?
The FDT 178, that's just it's nothing more than an ID number for okay. Which we're working. This particular area has roughly 240 premises in this area that we will be building out to.
Okay, thank you. That helps.
Any other questions?
Just a comment, last mile is an expensive proposition.
It is. Okay, hearing no further questions, is there a motion to approve capital budget revision, which is resolution number 13.
Mr. President, I move that we accept resolution 13 as presented.
Is there a second?
Second.
Been moved and seconded to approve resolution number 13. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is carried.
Commissioners, excuse me, this is Eric. With your permission, we'll have the minutes reflect the approval of that item 13 as a motion. It wasn't a resolution, it's a motion.
Okay.
I don't think you need a revote. We can simply have the minutes reflect with your permission that it was indeed a motion.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's what I intended anyway.
Yes. I was certain of that, Commissioner. Never a doubt.
Yeah. Are there any further manager items?
There is. So the board will recall that a couple of meetings ago we brought forward a discussion of a low-income weatherization program, and at that time we were looking for a head nod to proceed with the program, but there were a number of questions the board had and we pulled back from that. We have some additional information to provide today around that program, and we'll see whether that gets us to the point where we're ready to call the question on a head nod or not. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Andrew Grissel.
Great. Thank you, Steve. Rebecca, do you have that presentation? It's only a couple slides. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Andrew Grissel. I manage our Customer Energy Solutions team. I'm back before you to provide some additional information on the costs and benefits associated with the potential low-income programs we have shared with you. We can go to the next slide, please. So this slide should look familiar. However, I wanted to provide some additional clarity regarding the cost numbers at the bottom of the slide. If you'll recall, the bold numbers is the amount of dollars that can be spent and still be cost effective for the program. Those are also cumulative dollars, so it's not 150 plus 655 plus 915. It's the number as you move forward. Also, the smaller number below both the medium and expanded program bubbles is the amount of money that what we call community investment. Those are the dollars that are not covered in a cost-effective way. And so when we add those two, wanted to be very clear about what a total budget would look like. When we add those two, we have a total budget of $920,000 for the medium and $1.3 million for the expanded. Now recall, a large portion of that is cost-effective, but there is a small portion of that, or there is a portion of that that is not. And so if we go to the next slide, the question arose about, well, what is the cost effectiveness? And one of the ways we look at it is from a benefit cost ratio. We look at this with all of our programs, and generally we are looking for benefit cost ratios above a one. Almost all of our programs come in much higher than that. But for a low-income program where we don't have the ability to have any investment by the customer, so that's what makes our other programs cost-effective, because the customers put an investment in as well as our investment. So we don't have that ability with the low-income customers. And so wanted to share these numbers with you. So if the light program, that is we have a package box of things we can get out to customers. We really intended to use that to help us gather information as well. So those would be mailed out to customers that we identify. They're asked some questions. Hopefully they will call us and we can have a deeper discussion about really what their needs are. That's cost effective. So we've been moving it forward with that, and we're working towards getting those sent out. And that's a 1.39. Now the medium includes things like appliances as well as weatherization programs. Those weatherization programs are long-lived, generally, 30 to 45 years, and so we accrue benefits for a longer period of time. And so the cost effectiveness is just below a one. It's about a 0.95 for that program. And then as we look at the expanded program, that includes the fairly expensive items, service life of around 15 years or so, and that's looking at of HVAC equipment and some of those sorts of retrofits, and that's looking at a 0.77. And so I remember at the last meeting, Commissioner Arsenault requested that we provide, come back and provide this information. And so we have done so. I'd like to put it out there and ask if any of the commissioners have any questions.
Commissioners? Any questions, Commissioner?
If I could, I'd just like to make a comment, and that is that I appreciate the extra footwork, Andrew, that was done in coming up with the cost-benefit analysis. And this chart that we're looking at right now answers the question that I had in my mind very clearly. And I appreciate all the effort it took to arrive at that number. And the fact that the medium comes so close to a one gives me greater confidence. So thank you for your effort and your time.
You're welcome.
Any other questions?
Just a comment supporting what Gary just said. The this page really helps me think about this whole proposition, and I appreciate it very much.
Any other comments?
Randy, this is Ann.
Yes.
I support this as well. Important program. I want to thank Steve and Eric for helping me on this too. Spent quite a bit of time with me and helped me understand the numbers and so forth. So thank you.
Well, so Ann, since we can't see your head nodding, I'm assuming that's a yes nod. I can see the rest.
Yes, that's a definite head nod. Yes.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Steve, it appears that the board is comfortable with the medium approach.
Okay. I'm just watching all the board members here, and I think I'm seeing head nods from all of them. So I think we're good. Okay. So we will proceed with that. Essentially, what we'll be doing is developing the program, and that will go into the budget process for next year. So the formal approval for the board will come with the budget process next year, unless we feel that we need to move sooner than that, in which case we'll come back and talk to you about it. So I think we need. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Thank you.
Additional manager items.
We have no more.
All right. Down to commission items. We have a proposed tri-commission meeting. I don't know if others are looking at the motion that has been suggested to us.
Mr. President, I'd like to make a motion to move a special meeting on Tuesday, June 29th, 2021 at 1 p.m. to be held virtually for the purpose of holding a tri-commission meeting. The virtual meeting information should be posted on the PUD website.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to hold a tri-commission meeting on June 29th, 2021, 1 p.m., to be held virtually for the purpose of holding a tri-commission meeting. The meeting information will be posted on the PUD website. Before I call for the vote, if conditions change in our state as it relates to the quote virtual, will we be nimble enough to make that change and hold this meeting in a face-to-face fashion with a virtual option?
Commissioner, this is Eric. I would say we can be. If circumstances change, yes, depending upon how those circumstances change and what the requirements attached to that change are, it may require further board action, and it may not. At this point, though, yes, we will have the virtual option available, and we'll be monitoring that as we have been all of the changes and keep you updated as we move along.
Okay, realizing that I was totally out of line as the president asking that question, I think I called for discussion and there was none. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion is carried. Follow up on any other commission items? Any commissioners have any commission items?
Randy, this is Steve. Yep. Just going off of what that last discussion was, I didn't know, Steve, if there's been any discussion from your end with staff on the ramifications of the changes that are happening, what's been thinking. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm just kind of curious where people are thinking about the reopening and what the impacts are.
Yeah, we've had pretty extensive discussions about the governor's press conference last week, and the fundamental problem for us as an employer and for all employers is that the rules are written down and they are remain in place, both the governor's proclamation and the labor and industry standards that have been established about, for example, masks in the workplace and other requirements that employers have for dealing with COVID-19. So until those written rules change, we're still in the same place and are waiting to see what that will say. We speculated quite a bit about what that might say and what it might mean for us, but to be honest, it really is just speculation right now. Until we can see those rules, it's difficult to be able to make any sort of judgment. And that would apply to the situation with respect to the Tri-Commission as well.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other commission items? Hearing none. Item 16, follow-up on delegation of action items from the previous meeting.
We had two, both of which we just took care of. One of them was about getting more information on the cost per home and the cost effectiveness per home of the light, medium, and expanded low-income program tiers. And the other one was to provide information on the area median income, whether it's calculated by the county or community level, and Lindsay spoke to that in her presentation. I think both of those we'll consider checked off.
Okay. And delegation from today?
We don't have any recorded, so did we miss anything?
Okay, is there any additional public comment? Hearing none, are there any other matters of business that necessarily may come before the commission before we go into executive session for approximately 90 minutes to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCWs, and to evaluate the qualifications of an applicant for employment or to review the performance of a public employee as authorized by the RCWs. Now, that was a long-winded question about other matters to come before the commission. If there are none, let's take a 5-minute break and reconvene on the executive session line.